State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. The first case set for oral argument this morning is J&L Farms, Inc. versus Jackman, Florida Wagyu Beef and First Bank. Justin Scott is present, arguing on behalf of the appellant, and Zachary Peterson is present, will be arguing on behalf of the appellees. Brianna Hagen is also present on behalf of appellees. Each side will have 15 minutes for your oral arguments, and then Mr. Scott, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. So, Mr. Scott, you can proceed with your argument at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. May it please the Court and Counsel, I'd like to thank you for granting us the opportunity to appear in front of you today on this matter. This is a case out of the Circuit Court, Fifth Circuit, Brown County, under the Honorable Richard A. Summers. It involves letters issued by my client, First Bank, guaranteeing payment for purchases of cattle between J&L Farms, Inc. and Jackman, Florida Wagyu Beef. At the trial court, my client moved for a motion to dismiss based on lack of personal jurisdiction. That motion was denied by the trial court. We filed a petition for intermediate appeal, which was granted, and we're here today. The standard on a motion to dismiss, the court, it's a question of law, so this court reviews it de novo. In addition, when it's decided on written submissions at the trial court level, this court is to view the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. The first inquiry on personal jurisdiction is whether the legislature granted the court jurisdiction pursuant to the Long Arm Act, and second, whether that jurisdiction comports with due process. My understanding at this point is that the Long Arm Statute and due process are coextensive, and so I'll just move right into the minimum contacts requirement under federal due process. This court set forth a three-part test. I'm reading from Marshke v. Radislaw. First, the defendant must purposely avail himself to the privilege of acting in the forum state, thus invoking the benefits and protections of its laws. Second, the cause of action must arise from the defendant's activities directed at the forum state. Finally, the acts of the defendant must have substantial connection with the forum state to make the exercise of jurisdiction a reasonable one. The inquiry of whether the forum state may assert specific jurisdiction focuses on the relation between the defendant, the forum, and the litigation. Some single acts or occasional acts related to the forum may not be sufficient to establish jurisdiction if their nature and quality and the circumstances of their commission create only an attenuated affiliation with the forum. Most importantly, I think for this matter, the existence of a contract with a non-resident party is not alone sufficient to establish minimum contacts. The minimum contacts requirement is meant to ensure that a non-resident party will not be hailed into the forum solely on the basis of random, fortuitous, or attenuated contacts. As I said, this case involves three letters issued by First Bank guaranteeing payment of purchases of cattle between the other parties to this matter. Those letters were dated December 4th, 2018, December 18th, 2018, and January 8th, 2019. And by their terms, they were valid for a period of 30 days. First Bank is a Florida banking corporation. It has seven locations in Florida and no locations outside of Florida. They're not authorized to transact business in any other state. Joshua Whitehead, an employee of First Bank, drafted and executed the letters at issue addressed to J&L Farms. The letters were drafted at the request of Jackman, the First Bank's Florida-based customer. Mr. Whitehead did not have any contact with J&L Farms or anyone on its behalf in relation to the drafting, issuance, or provision of the letters. All of First Bank's communications regarding the letters was with its customer, Jackman, Florida Wagyu Beef. The The letters were supplied to Jackman, not to directly to J&L Farms. Jackman supplied the letters to J&L Farms. No representative of First Bank was ever in South Dakota to discuss dealings between Jackman and J&L Farms. And in fact, there was no contact between First Bank and J&L Farms regarding these matters. Other than the letters at issue, First Bank and J&L Farms have had no other dealings. So the only contacts we have between First Bank and South Dakota are these three letters that were addressed to a South Dakota entity. Although, as I stated, they weren't sent directly to the South Dakota entity. They were sent to First Bank's Florida customer. Anything else that might come up, I think, is based on conversations between J&L and Jackman, and I don't think it's appropriate under the circumstances to impute that to First Bank. And I don't believe that the parties, as I stated, the parties' contract alone is not sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. As this court said in Marshke, the existence of a contract with a non-resident party is not alone sufficient to establish minimum contacts. But to assert jurisdiction over First Bank in that case, all we have is these letters.
Yeah, does that rule even apply? The contract wasn't with the bank, or was it? The contract between the South Dakota company was with the non-resident buyer. Was there a contract in any way between the South Dakota supplier and the Florida bank?
To the extent you can view the letters as contracts. I mean, I think...
That's what I'm asking. Yeah. Is that a contract? Is that...
I believe in our answer that we stated that they would be an enforceable obligation according to their terms. Under the underlying facts of the case, we dispute whether they're enforceable at this point, but that's a question for another day. So I guess that's my answer to that.
Thank you.
Under Marshke, since the contract alone was not enough, the court stated that they must then determine if the sum total of the rest of Radislaw's acts in that case added to the contract constitute sufficient minimum contacts. In the Burger King case, the court stated that other cases have looked to prior negotiations and contemplated future consequences along with the terms of the contracts and the parties' actual course of dealing. But we have no other facts. We have no other acts to consider in this case.
Opposing counsel has cited several cases around the country that have found that in certain circumstances, guarantees can be sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. Do you wish to address those at all?
I can. I think those cases are all distinguishable because there's something more to them than there is in this case. The two cases out of Nebraska, Quality Pork, that was the guarantor. It was more than a guarantee. It was the third party becoming primarily liable for the debts owed by the third party. In Hand-Cut Steaks, the other Nebraska case, the obligation was unique to Nebraska. It was a guarantee to a Nebraska corporation of a lease of Nebraska property. And the court said that where the obligation is unique to the forum, that then can establish the jurisdiction. And in fact, that court said that a guarantee of personal debt generally bears no intrinsic connection to any particular location, which I believe is the case here. I don't think there's any particular circumstances in this case that warrant jurisdiction in South Dakota.
So it seems like a lot of the cases on jurisdiction relating to guarantees come down to the extent of the inducement, rather than whether the guarantor induced the party to act and enter into the contract and proceed with the negotiation. Seems like you have a lot of inducement in this case, don't you? You have, my understanding, and there's not a lot of detail in the record, my understanding is there may have been some cash deals originally where Wagman was buying, and then they said, well, we want to switch, so we've got a little bit more ability for flexibility. So we want to do some credit sales. And so, you know, the letter First Bank sends out says the purpose of this letter is to allow the bank from J&L Farms to be purchased under the terms agreed upon by Jackman Wagyu Beef, and J&L Farms. In other words, the bank understood the whole purpose of this letter was to get J&L Farms to enter into a credit transaction. So isn't that quite a bit of an inducement in this case? I mean, because that's what these cases turn on is evidence of inducement. What is that letter except we're inducing you to enter into a credit transaction with these people, and we're guaranteeing we're gonna pay it three times.
But is an inducement? I mean, anytime there's a guarantee, there's some level of inducement. I mean, I don't think somebody.
No question. But this is specific to this transaction. You know, I realize there's guarantors and in various corporate situations and things like that, and to what extent those induce, I don't know. But this is very specific. It says we're doing it, so you'll agree to these terms with because otherwise, you're not going to send a bunch of cattle down to Omaha to be slaughtered with some person down in Florida if you don't think you're going to get paid.
And I think there's cases that go both ways on whether that pronouncement of inducement in the document is enough to establish jurisdiction. Certainly the appellee has set forth cases that talk about reliance and those things. I'd direct you to the Long John Silver's case, which I cited in my brief. Both of the guarantees in that said, we're doing this as an inducement to enter into this franchise agreement with this corporation, and we're doing this as an inducement to enter into a real estate lease with those people. So there's cases that go both ways as to whether that statement of inducement is sufficient.
So is it a judgment call for us?
Well, as I see it, it would require this court to pronounce a rule to that effect.
Because we don't have any guarantor cases or guarantee cases right now that I'm aware of.
And so no, and I would agree with that. It would require the court to go with that line of cases, I think, that says that that's enough. And I guess my position on that is I don't think that necessarily squares with this court's prior pronouncements. This court has always looked to the minimum contacts requirements. I think this case can be decided based on the pronouncements of law in both the Marschke case and the Custom Cycles case. And the Marschke case says the contracts alone are not enough. You have to look to the other contacts that they had. And the Custom Cycles case says, it's not enough that the non-resident defendant knew that the plaintiff was a resident of the forum, or that the performance would occur in the forum. So, if we're going to follow current precedents, then I think the court would have to announce a new rule having to do with the inducement factor.
Is there a difference between inducing someone to enter into a contract and the inducement that might subject somebody to personal jurisdiction in the forum? And is it important, perhaps, to keep those distinctions clear and neat? In other words, there may be inducement to enter into the contract and subject the guarantor to liability, but does that necessarily mean that they're purposefully availing themselves of personal jurisdiction within the forum? Those seem like two different concepts.
And I would agree with that. Under the purposeful availment factor, one of the things you look at is whether the non-resident defendant is invoking the benefits and protections of the law of the forum. And in Miller v. Weber, this court found it significant that the appellee would not have been able to enforce any contract in the South Dakota courts because his only contract was with a party in New Mexico. In a similar vein, in North Carolina case, United Buying Group v. Coleman, they talked about how the guarantor incurred a potential liability to a North Carolina corporation with no attending commercial benefits to himself enforceable in the courts of North Carolina. Likewise, in the Bond Leather case, the court stated they could not identify any contract rights created by the guarantee in the guarantor, which could have been enforced in the Massachusetts court, which could fairly be said to represent intent by the guarantor to reap the benefits of Massachusetts law. I can't envision a scenario under these letters as they stand where First Bank could avail itself of the courts in this state. There's no obligations undertaken by J&L Farms under those letters. So I think in line with those cases I cited, that purposeful availment factor isn't met here. I would also say that the contacts of J&L Farms with First Bank with J&L Farms are random, fortuitous, and attenuated to the extent that First Bank was not seeking to do business with the South Dakota entity. They were doing business with their Florida customer. Their Florida customer happened to do business with the South Dakota entity. And then the Custom Cycles case, this court talked about how Boyer wasn't seeking a South Dakota customizer. He happened to do business with a customizer that was in South Dakota.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Now, Mr. Peterson, you can proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here today on behalf of J&L Farms, which is a cattle producer and farming operation up by Claremont. I agree with Mr. Scott that this appeal really concerns one single issue, which is whether a South Dakota court's exercise of personal jurisdiction over defendant First Bank comports with the requirements of due process. And more specifically, did First Bank have sufficient minimum contacts with this forum for the court to exercise personal jurisdiction? J&L's position is obviously that the trial court correctly recognized that this case involves multiple guarantees issued to a South Dakota business that were intended to induce very specific actions, that is, repeated shipments of cattle from South Dakota to Omaha for the benefit of defendant Jackman, and it's appropriate for South Dakota courts to exercise jurisdiction over First Bank. I also agree that this is subject to a three-step analysis. And the first question under that analysis is whether defendant First Bank purposefully availed itself of the privilege of acting in South Dakota. Mr. Scott touched on this, and an important consideration in the review of this matter is that this court reviews the circuit court's determination regarding personal jurisdiction based on written submissions in the light most favorable to the non-moving party. In this case, the written submissions do have some contents that I think are key in evaluating jurisdiction here. First of all, you've got the three separate guarantees for three separate cattle transactions. This was not an isolated guarantee that was part of some larger transaction than just kind of a side piece to an agreement. These were tailored to specific cattle transactions which were intended to get J&L to ship those cattle out of South Dakota down to Omaha. And I'd also say that the written submissions show that these guarantees were part of a course of financial dealing that Jackman and First Bank were involved in. If you look at the record, you've got a November 16, 2018 email from defendant Jackman stating that the South Dakota transactions would be backed by a bank guarantee. In other words, this was not a one-shot deal like what was happening in Marshke. The contacts were not random, fortuitous, or attenuated. The contacts were regular. They occurred over the course of three times in 6 weeks. There was an email that kind of described how these transactions were going to go down. And
contacts were with Jackman alone, not with First Bank. Is that true?
Yes, but if you read the email, it actually describes in there what the bank wanted to happen. And that is, they did not want Jackman to use its line of credit to purchase these cattle. They wanted Jackman to only use its line of credit on the cattle that it was going to raise and to purchase outside cattle on these term arrangements. Mm-hmm. That's the reason for the need for the guarantees. So these guarantees were integral to these transactions. And First Bank's banker knew that when he sat down and drafted these guarantees. He knew that they were going to be sent up to South Dakota and that that was going to induce J&L to send these cattle as directed by Jackman. In that way, First Bank was creating continuing obligations each time it directed a guarantee to J&L. It did so deliberately. This was not a random fortuitous event. I mentioned that email from November 16, 2018. That's in the settled record at page 73. You know, the idea that was set up here between First Bank and Jackman was that Jackman would be able to process and sell its beef and then pay J&L. And if you look at that email, it actually states, quote, "Our banker would really like to see us use our line of credit on our own cattle rather than use it on outside purchase cattle." So behind the scenes, First Bank played a role in how these cattle transactions were structured. It injected itself into these cattle transactions. So I don't think the fact that the communications were between First Bank, between Jackman and J&L isn't the end of the story, is what I'm getting at, Justice Kern.
Is there any evidence in the record that J&L knew that Jackman was in financial difficulty of any kind? I couldn't find any evidence of that in the record.
I don't believe there is.
So the nature of the conversation between the First Bank and Jackman are just that. It's the terms of the bank's guarantee to Jackman. There's no reason to believe that J&L had any knowledge that Jackman's in any kind of financial trouble or any information that there was any problem with this transaction.
Not with respect to the time frame in which the guarantees were issued. I don't know when it became apparent, but during that December 2018 to January 2019 period, I'm not aware of any evidence that J&L had any suspicion that there were financial problems with Jackman.
Mr. Peterson, I thought I saw a reference in the record somewhere that maybe there were some transactions before these three credit sales.
Yes.
Is there any detail about that in the record as to what whether they were cash sales or what those transactions were?
Prior to December of 2018, the transactions had been cash sales.
And do we know that definitively from the record? Is that clear in the record?
I don't know that it is. I mean, I know that it's alleged in our complaint that they had prior transactions and that those transactions had been processed without any sort of a guarantee or anything like that, and that the relationship went back to 2016. I can't, off the top of my head, pinpoint anything that was specific to that issue in the affidavits or documents submitted. I know that the change was requested by Jackman in November of 2018, and it's at least apparent from that email that the reason for the change was because the bank did not want them using their line of credit to purchase these outside cattle. I don't know if that had to do with a security issue or what, but that was at least part of the impetus for the creation of these guarantees and why they started backing each transaction with one of them. So I think what I'm getting at is behind the scenes, First Bank did have involvement and it did purposely avail itself of the South Dakota forum. I don't think, and this gets more into the second point of whether the defendant's actions were directed at the forum state, I don't think the fact that they were routing these guarantees through Jackman should have any impact on the analysis. What other purpose could these guarantees possibly be for if they were not going to be transmitted on to J&L?
Well, they say J&L Farms.
Yeah, they're clearly, and in fact, they have Curtis Larson's name right on them, who's the principal of J&L Farms. So, you know, the suggestion that they're not, that they're, the communication was with, between First Bank and Jackman only, I think is a little bit misleading because it's clearly implied that these are going to be sent on. They were, in fact, sent on. So, you know, this was something where First Bank knew why they were drafting these guarantees. They knew where they were going to end up.
Counsel, could you address the opposing argument that, unlike a situation where they are direct parties to the contract itself, where this is a guarantee, that what scenario would there have been where the bank would ever need to avail itself of the South Dakota courts if J&L owed no obligation to the bank? I think that was the argument made by opposing counsel.
I guess the argument could be made that the bank, to invalidate the guarantee, would maybe try to invoke the South Dakota jurisdiction, whether through a declaratory judgment action or something like that. That's the situation that comes to mind in my mind is if the bank was presented with a claim under the guarantee, or it was if J&L was trying to enforce a judgment that was rendered up here, would they then come to South Dakota to try to invalidate that as a remedy? That's one possible circumstance where I could envision them invoking the jurisdiction of South Dakota to deal with the guarantee.
Or what if Wegman had a claim for the beef was bad, it wasn't certified Wagyu beef, and maybe the bank, that claim was assigned to the bank. Could the bank litigate that in South Dakota?
I think they could. And I think the other thing that, getting back to the fairness of hailing them into South Dakota courts, when you look at this, the way that this set up really kind of shows how my client got invested in this situation and why it is fair to bring First Bank here to litigate this. The first transaction was December 4th of 2018. That was the first cattle shipment under the first guarantee. And Jackman paid for those cattle, so we don't have an issue with that. December 18th of 2018 is the second shipment. J&L shipped 42 cattle on that date on the 30-day terms. And then January 8th, 2019, before payment was due on the prior one, they shipped another 43 head on the 30-day terms. By this point in time, J&L had shipped about $150,000 worth of cattle out of South Dakota, and both of those transactions were backed by the guarantees. So I agree. The question was asked earlier about the inducement in this transaction. It was significant. I think that's a key factor in the analysis of whether it's fair to bring First Bank to South Dakota to litigate this issue. As I've described, First Bank played a part in how these structures came to pass. If Jackman had used its line of credit, we wouldn't be here. I mean, there would be no South Dakota case because J&L would have been the one getting paid and First Bank would have been on the hook under its own loan terms. So the fact that it directed the way these transactions happened with the guarantees being sent to back these cattle shipments, I think makes it entirely fair to bring First Bank to South Dakota to litigate this issue. And it should have recognized that if things went wrong between Jackman and J&L, then its name was going to be on the caption as well. And that gets into some of the, in Burger King, the United States Supreme Court talked about a state's manifest interest in providing its residents with a convenient forum for redress. And as the circuit court recognized, it's very troubling to think that a bank could send these guarantees on one transaction after another and then not expect to be hailed into South Dakota courts to deal with them. And, those are really the issues that I think stuck with the circuit court, and I think that's the reason there is that level of reasonableness or that level of fairness in having First Bank litigate these issues in South Dakota.
So is the inducement argument that you're making, you mentioned a couple minutes ago, and I'm just kind of thinking about it now, that it was somehow in First Bank's interests, their own interests, to have J&L not use, or excuse me, to have Jackman not use the line of credit. And that was better for them, or something that perhaps they wanted. They wanted this arrangement more so than their customer tapping that line of credit, and that maybe this is a product of that, so somehow perhaps they had an interest or self-interest in doing this.
That's absolutely it, and I think, that when you're talking about the standard that applies here and giving us the benefit of, the favorable inferences and things like that, you have a statement made by the representative from Jackman that says the bank doesn't want us using the line of credit on these transactions. That's why we're going to give you these guarantees.
And that enhances, in your view, the idea that you're contacting the forum, you're purposefully availing, you're anticipating or should reasonably anticipate being hailed into a South Dakota court.
Correct. Unless the court has further questions.
Isn't it the contact between the defendant and the forum? You're driving at you're saying, well, the bank has directed the manner in which this transaction should occur, but isn't that between Jackman and the bank and not the contact between the defendant bank and South Dakota?
We have both. I mean, you have Jackman as the one collaborating with J&L on how these transactions are going to go down, but then you have First Bank backing them with their guarantee letters, which they knew were going to get to J&L. So I think you have both, and you have them on three separate occasions. J&L respectfully ask that the circuit court's order denying the motion to dismiss be affirmed, and unless the court has further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Scott, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you. There was a lot of talk about this email between Jackman and J&L Farms, and you hit on it that the minimum contacts requirement can't be based on contacts between the plaintiff and the forum or a third party in the forum. And First Bank was not included on that email. They weren't even particularly named in that email. I mean, all it says is our Florida bank or our local bank. And I think what I heard here is that if we're looking to that email, the guarantees were based on relationships between First Bank and J&L Farms, not any requirement First Bank and Jackman, not any requirement by J&L Farms that you guys have financial trouble, we need some backing here. And so I think that undercuts the inducement argument. There wasn't any particular requirement that I see here from J&L Farms that, hey, we need these guarantees. It was something that was decided on, if you're viewing the email, decided on between First Bank and Jackman.
So I go back to the language, and you used it when you started your argument, random, fortuitous, and attenuated. And if it is, then we don't have jurisdiction over a party outside South Dakota. So you've got these three transactions. You've got a letter of credit. It's addressed to a South Dakota entity. It says we're going to pay for this transaction three times, and we're going to pay it to this entity located in Claremont, South Dakota. From the bank's perspective, thinking about, could we possibly get sued in South Dakota? How is that random, fortuitous, and attenuated after three letters of credit like that? If this deal goes bad, could the bank reasonably make the argument there's no way we get sued in South Dakota on this deal?
Yeah, I'd
expect to be sued in South Dakota on
this
deal?
I don't think can we expect to be sued in South Dakota because we address these to a South Dakota entity as the standard. If you look at custom cycles, like I said, they talked about, it essentially goes back to Burger King, where they're reaching out beyond their borders to attempt to purposely avail themselves of the forum and the benefits and protections of the laws of the forum. I think this is random and attenuated because First Bank was not saying, hey, we want to do business in South Dakota, we want to do business with a South Dakota entity. They were doing this because their customer, who was Florida-based, had chosen to do business with a South Dakota entity.
What if the arrangement had worked initially? And let's say things had gone off as planned. Jackman pays, and we go down the road 12, 24 months. But each month, or from time to time, there's this periodic guarantee. And so three isn't three. Three is 15. What about that? Is that random? Is that fortuitous?
I think there'd be a better argument at that point.
But what's the difference substantively? More?
The long-standing relationship, the continuing obligations, you know, in the instance we're talking about here, it was three letters over the course of 35 days, which, according to the terms, the last would have been effective through about 65 days after the last transaction.
So over time, the bank could more reasonably expect to be held into a South Dakota court than it would perhaps at the outset?
I think that would comport more with the jurisprudence on this issue, in that the courts have said to look to things like long-standing relationships. I mean, in the Daktronics case talked about the fact that this was a three-year contract, so there was this long relationship.
A lot more context on that one, too. But
yeah, I agree. But so I think that's the difference there. Mr. Peterson talked about he didn't think routing the letters through Jackman had any substance to it. I don't think that's a determinative issue, and I don't think it was meant for the benefit of, hey, we're going to give this to our Florida clients so we have some sort of insulation here. I think it just illustrates that they were dealing with their Florida client. And again, it's that issue of, were they reaching out to South Dakota to conduct activities here and prevail itself of the laws here? And I don't think that's the case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll be in recess until 9:45.